Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. 11 minutes after 9 o'clock, we start off our show with an open discussion of issues in the news and beyond, a roundtable on the roundtable, if you will. Joining me for the discussion today, WAMC's Alan Shartok, our morning edition host, David Gustina, University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter, Rosemary R. Mayo. This morning we'll talk about President Obama returning 5% of his salary in solidarity with those affected by sequestration, the Obama administration pushing for banks to make home loans to people with weaker credit. Also about this business with the U.S. Embassy tweeting parts of Jon Stewart's monologue on Egypt and the row that has started over that. Jimmy Fallon will be taking over The Tonight Show. The latest updates on gun violence and the debate surrounding that. So all of that on the way in this hour, in theory. You can join us by emailing us at roundtable@wamc.org. You can also comment on our webpage, that's wamc.org, and then look for the roundtable, or our Facebook page, that's WAMC Radio, or you can tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. You got all that? All right, that's all the time we have for today's show, so goodbye.
All right,
so let's welcome our panel. Dave Gustina, nice to have you here.
And good to be here with you, Ray.
Rosemary, saving us once again, as you do every week. Alan, good to have you here.
Thank you.
I thought we would start the show today like the old McLaughlin Group show.
Wrong!
Issue one, in a budget gesture, Obama will return 5% of his salary. Meaningful action or more showbiz? Rosemary.
Showbiz.
David?
Showbiz, but it might work.
In what way?
Perception.
Alan?
Well, you know, a while back, WAMC had some tough times. And we did furloughs. Everybody had to take a couple. What was it, two or something like that? Furloughs?
I don't remember.
Yes, it was not a lot.
We blocked it out from our collective memory.
Yes. It was not a lot. But I took, you know, I wasn't going to take a furlough, but I was going to take a hit in terms of my salary. Because it's not only the perception on the outside, it's the perception of your colleagues, the people who are doing the work. And, you know, there's always water cooler griping that, he didn't do it, we had to do it. So I think that while it is showbiz, and I agree with everybody, I think it may have more to do with the way in which his team takes what he's doing than what's going on the outside. Because I tell you, I think he's going to take more grief for having done it on the outside than he gets credit.
Okay, well, I remember when the Wall Street stuff was coming down and everybody was getting a bailout and those huge bonuses were going out. And we were all told, oh, it doesn't mean anything. It's just a small amount. And I was outraged by it. I thought that
the bankers
took the bonuses, and I thought that they should not. So in that regard, I agree with you, Alan. He should not be taking the money. But it is showbiz. He did not take the action until after his Secretary of Defense and the Assistant Secretary of Defense did it. It was almost like they showed him up, sort of like Biden did on
gay rights.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And also what we really need from the president is not to give the measly $20,000 back that he's giving, but real leadership that would have prevented this stupid sequester.
You know, if anybody ever did to Andrew Cuomo what you just said was done to the president, anybody in his cabinet ever, you know, sort of pulled the rug out from under him, I don't think they would have been there that much longer.
Yeah.
So, as you mentioned, $20,000, it's not a great deal, especially when you consider he's not paying rent. You know,
The Obamas make almost $800,000 a year.
Right.
And he's giving back $20,000. Now, to me, that would be like a ton of money, and I really wouldn't want to do it. So I don't mean to put it down. It's all percentages. But what I really want from the president is, why do we have this sequester? Stop it.
Well, you can ask the president, and of course, equally ask John Boehner and others.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not all on the president, although he's making a move here. And I noticed the senator from Alaska, a Democrat, also doing the same thing. So will it lead to everybody on Capitol Hill or a good number of people who want to get reelected doing the same thing?
Let's see some of those Tea Party guys give back their money.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting because Mike McNulty once made a point right here, and somebody called up and reminded us of that on Vox Pop yesterday, that everybody in both the House and Senate is a millionaire. So, you know, giving up a little money is symbolic, but it doesn't kill you. if you're a pipe fitter and you're making so much an hour, it may really hurt you a lot more.
Isn't this all a sign of how out of touch many of these politicians are with the general public? I mean, you know, they're talking about sequester. They talk about these large numbers of people affected as if they're not people. Right. And meanwhile, there are people hurting in the country. And, you know, gestures like this don't necessarily help.
I know this is a little bit of a deviation from the conversation, but you're so right about at what point you think of somebody as a person as opposed to a statistic. On the Media Project this week, we were talking about the fact, and we have before, that we now hear the voices of the Supreme Court in the court.
Yeah.
It should be on television. We all know it. But at least we hear their voices. And all of a sudden, we think of them as human beings. I actually liked Anthony Kennedy when I heard him there. He's a human being.
Does that surprise you?
Yeah. Because, you know, I think of them as a block of conservative Republicans, you know, who make these decisions. And yet, when you heard Kennedy questioning the lawyers and everything else, you had a feeling that this guy had a soul.
Especially when he's talking about children.
Yeah. That's it.
You're looking at me.
Back to you, Ray.
Sorry, Ray.
All right, fair enough. What do you say, Ray?
Well, you know, we're going to...
Wrong.
Wrong, Martin Kondracki. All right, this is the roundtable, not the McLaughlin Group, thank heavens. I do want to say that you can check in via social media. You can go to our Facebook page, and that's WAMC Radio. Or you can go to our webpage, WAMC.org, and then go to the Roundtable page. There's a place where you can comment. Or you could tweet us at WAMC Roundtable or email us at roundtable@WAMC.org. We'll hit issue number 2 coming up in a moment. We'll take a short break. It's the Roundtable on WAMC. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue, 19 minutes after 9 o'clock. We're joined this morning by our regular contributor and a regular contributor to the Media Project, Rosemary Armeo, Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter, David Gustina, our Morning Edition host,
right,
and Alan Shartok, our man about town, bon vivant. Welcome all. And we talked about the 5% return from President Obama of his salary. I thought we would move to an item I saw yesterday afternoon, mid-afternoon, on the Washington Post website. Caught my eye. And I'll read you the first paragraph. It's an article by Zachary A. Goldfarb. The Obama administration is engaged in a broad push to make more home loans available to people with weaker credit, an effort that officials say will help power the economic recovery, but that skeptics say could open the door to the risky lending that caused the housing crash in the first place. Let's first send it to Alan. Alan, what do you say?
Well, that's a very good point. And before you hit that second part, I was thinking that, you know, wasn't Andrew Cuomo the administrator of HUD back in the day?
Yes.
And, you know, he wanted, I think correctly, to get as many people into houses as he could. And there are some people who argue that that's the kind of behavior that caused the housing crisis. So that if you... banks have to be conservative lenders because otherwise there's going to be, a U.S. Senate committee at some point looking at what they did and why they did it and when they did it. It's always a careful balancing act. You give people money who you know very well won't pay it back, then you have created a hell for yourself.
Rosemary.
Well, I'm on the fence on this one. I think on the face of it, it sounds like a good idea. Let people who are just like under, a little bit under the standards get money. However, we saw what happened when that went way, way, way too far. And we don't have banks regulated well in this country anymore. So I don't want to say, oh, yeah, let the bankers decide. They really know. They should have known. And they look what they proved to us that they did. So I don't think it's a good idea.
Well, you make a point. In your first sentence, you said, you know, people who are just under.
Right.
And I think that is what the Obama administration says here. It's like, since the housing crash, lenders are so concerned that you have to have a near perfect score to get a loan.
Correct.
And I think
it was like 700.
That's right.
Yeah. And so what they're saying is there are a lot of people in the 680 range, or, you know, give or take, who are perfectly fine. You have to look at the whole picture here. And we have to get some new homeowners back into the market. David?
Well, I just worry about the flip side of this, which is the homeowners who pay their mortgages and do what they're supposed to do and live the sort of upstanding citizen life. in the end, you see a lot of these folks, and many of them were, you know, sort of tricked and fooled into some of this, but it's hard for me, especially as someone who tries to read all the fine print and make sure I can afford to pay for my house, that not only do they fail and go into foreclosure, but then they get bailed out, many of them.
Well, okay. Now, and a lot of these loans are FHA loans, federally backed loans. Mm-hmm. So if there is another situation where people are defaulting in great numbers, taxpayers are picking up the slack.
And my question would be, if you wanted to comment on this, all you have to do is go to your email and do and mail something to roundtable@wamc.org, right?
Right. I did say that. Something, yes.
No, I know you said it, and I'm not being critical of you at all, ever.
No, never happens.
No. I never do that.
Right. Gentlemen,
but
I wanted to make
a personal appeal.
Okay.
Because there's somebody sitting there, and sometimes you have to have a personal appeal as opposed to, you know, just the flourish of things. I want you to go to roundtable@wamc.org and
yes.
let us know what you think.
Particularly if you have a low interest home offer
exactly.
for our spam box.
Exactly.
That would be great. So so you have nothing more to say then about taxpayers picking up the tab
Well, there are lots of ways that taxpayers, Ray, pick up the tab. I mean, obviously, if We have social service programs where we pick up the tab for people. We have school systems where you may not be a parent anymore and your kids may be off to something and you're paying school taxes. So we have a lot of redistribution of wealth things going on in every government. And it's always a question of how much you want to do. Now, I think it's fair to say, Ray, that I'm a little bit more liberal on this than some other people.
Yeah, but
getting back to the
I know what shots you're trying to take.
Okay.
Getting back to the housing bubble and federally backed loans, is it appropriate to say, well, we're going to loosen the standards a bit, and if it fails, if it all goes sky high, you, the taxpayer, are on the line?
Well, it depends what you think of as the word fair. You know, means President Kennedy said there is no fairness. You know, I mean, it's a matter of balancing. It's a matter of, do we want to pay for health care for people who have no health care? The answer is yes, I do. I think every industrial nation should do it, and we should.
But that again is not
okay. But there's a middle ground in this. I'm shaking my head at this whole discussion. There's a middle ground here. The government can say yes, we want to have people in say the 680 to 700 range get. But then isn't there somebody in the government who's going to go back and check on the banks? That was the part missing last time, and make sure that we haven't dipped into the 480 area, which is where we were. That's what was missing. Not that there's an effort to get people. Of course, we should be helping young people to get houses, and we should be helping people who haven't yet had a chance to prove what they can earn. But that's not what happened the last time, and I don't see that we have the protections in place to prove that it won't happen again.
So nothing much changed. They didn't learn much.
Tell me what did. What regulations do we have on banks now? We didn't do very well on that.
Well, we do know they've tightened lending. According to this article from the Post, before the crisis, 40% of home buyers, first-time purchasers. That's down at least 10% right now. And I think the Obama administration says, well, let's try to jack that up a little bit here. Mm-hmm. You know, we've purchased one, my family, we've had one house, and it's not always easy to keep up with that. I mean, we bought it at the peak of the market, you know, perhaps foolishly.
They had to live somewhere.
Right. I mean, it was either that or a refrigerator box, right?
Right.
So, Dave, anything more on this before we move to the next topic?
Well, again, I'm with both of Alan and Rosemary on this. I see all these sides. But the big deal is that I think a lot of the American people wanted to see the banks punished and the Wall Street folks punished for what they did. You didn't see any of them other than Bernie Madoff being dragged away. And that was a Ponzi scheme unto itself. So
the government said, be kind to people. And they went out and just gave ridiculous loans. And as you mentioned, they tricked people into taking loans that they never should have. I understand that there was like some people who took loans they never should have, but there was a whole lot the other way too. And there are no protections in place that I'm aware of that would stop that from happening.
From the amount of pain it's all caused to so many people, not only in this country,
but around the world, I think,
you know, there should have been some punishment.
Well, and yet, you know, you take a look at that cabinet. The Clinton cabinet, and you take a look at the way the system,
the Obama cabinet.
Yeah.
And you take a look at the way the system was working, and or not working, and you say, okay, our banks are in crisis, they're going to fail. We've got to bail them out.
Right.
That was what was going on. Now you look at who's doing the bailing out. You get guys like Geithner.
Right.
And there's other guys who come right out of that system.
Absolutely.
Was it brilliant to appoint a Geithner to that Secretary of Treasury thing? Probably.
Yeah.
Because if you want, you know, it's some of us will consider it reprehensible. But on the other hand, if you didn't go along with the existing system in order to repair it, things could have been far worse in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes you got to do what you don't
that.
Like.
No, I agree with that.
I think the one point that I like in what the administration is saying, the one thing I like most is they say, you know, you have to look at the totality. In other words, a 650 credit score doesn't mean that much unless you get the bigger picture. So maybe that is making some motion. We're going to take a break in a moment, and then we'll come back with an item. And maybe Rosemary can explain it for us now in the minute we have before news. She brought this to my attention yesterday. And it's this whole hubbub over John Stewart's monologue. And the
Edward R. Murrow of today.
So what's up with that? You explain it, set it up. We'll come back after the news and talk about it.
Okay, well, he did two monologues on Morsi, the president of Egypt, who sent a comedian to jail for making fun of him, for doing this the very same thing that John Stewart does.
Yeah.
And he called him out and said, when you have real power, you don't need to put comedians in jail. And our embassy tweeted this approvingly.
So they tweeted parts of the monologue.
Parts of the monologue, which of course are very critical of the Egyptian government, and the Egyptian government had a fit over it.
And this gentleman, Bassam Youssef.
Yes.
He's known as the Egyptian John Stewart. So there was solidarity with John Stewart.
He is, and
he's even sat with John Stewart, I believe.
He has. They're buddies. You know, they have a communion. And he made fun of the president of Egypt, the hat he wore, and his bad use of English. And, of course, then Stewart shows a picture of George Bush, and both of them have hats.
Because, yeah.
That's all I did.
But I've had my run-ins with wearing hats and speaking bad English.
For 8 years.
And let's just all remember that I believe Egypt is the second largest recipient of American aid in the world.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Indeed. And Stewart makes a point of that in his monologue. It's a brilliant monologue. I really go watch it on YouTube. It's really wonderful.
All right. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about this and many other things coming up on the roundtable. First, we'll take a short break. We'll get some business done, and then we'll go to news. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. 9:36 is the time. We're joined by Rosemary Armeo, Alan Chartok, and David Gustina. And our producer, Sarah LaDuke, is here with some missives from social media and email and whatnot.
They're both from email, actually. Okay. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning, Sarah.
Joseph wrote in and said, great new forum. An essential point is being missed here in terms of the history. Sorry, let's learn how to read. History of the Great Recession. The housing crisis was not caused by loose lending standards. The crisis itself was caused by massive fraud on the part of the banks in securitizing bad loans or loans that were presented as something more than they were. That means that by repackaging the loans as low risk, that created the crash and has prevented the unwinding of these loans. If it were just too lenient loans, then a number of banks would have failed, not the entire global economy, and the fix would have been easy to modify loans one-on-one between lender and borrower. That cannot happen when the loans are bundled and then resold as securities bought by pension funds and infecting the entire market with the fraud those securities represented, and not a single banker goes to jail. So it's not just about banks being too lenient. That's all I got. Love you guys.
Well, that's what Rosemary
great.
Said.
It's a great oh, that's letter. Great. Yeah. Write it. More. Write more.
Thanks, Joseph.
And I like that thing at the end where he says, not just about that. Yes, that's very important.
And then the
Bravo.
Other email from Dan basically says the same thing. The financial industry gave us the crisis by making exotic derivatives out of subprime loans. Those were not government-backed loans.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us. And you can always check in via email, roundtable@wamc.org, or any of the social media. You can find out about that at the Roundtable page at our website, wamc.org.
But you know, Rex,
you've raised your hand, so you may speak.
Whatever your name is, Ray.
That's right.
Not Rex.
That's David.
But you make a very good point, because I think a lot of people who may not be familiar with all of the other things, the Facebooks and the, you know, things, do know how to email. And email is easy here. It's just roundtable@wamc.org.
That's
and we
right.
really want you to do
you
it.
You like the email. That you understand.
I do. I have the Facebook too, and you know,
don't like the Facebook,
tweet
though.
And stuff. But I really like email. It's a gentlemanly and a gentlelady way.
Well, you had a telegraph until recently, right?
I did. Yeah.
Good. Stop. All right.
When I grew up on Fire Island, by the way, the job. Yeah. The only way you were allowed to ride a bike on Fire Island was if you were the telegraph deliverer. And I thought I'd mention that now, even though nobody cares.
Fascinating. So getting back to it, thank you for that, Alan. And thank you, Sarah. We appreciate that. So we were discussing before the news, briefly, something I was unaware of until Rosemary emailed me yesterday afternoon. The U.S. Embassy tweeted Jon Stewart's parts of his monologue related to the Egyptian Jon Stewart and being arrested. And the embassy, tail between its legs, upset, pulled its Twitter account for a while. Explain this, and why is this at all an issue?
In journalism school, we talk about the CNN effect. It was the idea that what happened on the news would have an impact on what leaders did, what officials and diplomats did. And that began, of course, with CNN years ago. It's like 20 years old now. You're now seeing that explode it with the new the media that we've been talking about, all the Twitter and Facebooks and all that. And that's what happened here. A comedy show in the United States. It's much more, let's be honest, than a comedy show. It's pungent social commentary. It is news. Jon Stewart's one of the best newsmen around.
In fact, was there a study, Rosemary, that showed that 50% of the young people were getting their news from Jon Stewart?
Some might argue more truth.
Yeah, and a lot more truth.
Critical thinking, at least.
He does news in the tradition of I.F. Stone. He shows what people said in the past and what they say now and says, hey, how about the difference here? It's great journalism. Anyway,
I.F. Stone.
you telegraphed him.
No. I knew I.F. Stone.
He's wonderful.
Yeah, he was. But I think you could describe him as a little bit more to the left than Jon Stewart. I think Jon Stewart is much more of a sort of everyman's incisive, looker at these issues.
He's got real precise principles too, like be fair to veterans and be honest and be open. So what happens then is he has a show. It's a great show, a very very to the point. But it's the embassy tweeting it that makes it interesting.
Yeah.
And this is an embassy that has gotten in trouble before by saying things that are anti-Egyptian government. When remember just before the Benghazi attack, there was a raid on the U.S. embassy in Egypt, and the embassy put out information about it that they were criticized for later.
Now, Rosemary, you've been so active in international investigative reporting, but it would occur to me that, you know, would they do it without going higher up and asking the Secretary of State or the President's people?
They would. There's a lot of autonomy in the field. Uh-huh. And I believe that did happen back in September just before the Benghazi, and it definitely happened here. They put that out.
Something tells me a memo went out shortly after.
And it had to have. And then, of course, there is this outsized response from the Morsi government, which, as Jon Stewart pointed out, needs a thicker skin.
Yeah.
And they said it was completely inappropriate for this anti-Egyptian propaganda to be broadcast by the U.S. Embassy. And suddenly the whole Twitter account crashes.
Yeah.
And when it comes back up, this part is missing. It's not there anymore.
The State Department said the unusual affair was the result of, quote, glitches in the embassy's social media policies that are now being corrected. My question is, how many people in Egypt are following on Twitter the U.S. Embassy? I mean, it has to be a fairly small number, yes?
No, I think it's pretty high. And I think it goes not just, maybe not the embassy account, but the embassy stuff is then translated to other people. It is huge. Social media among young people in the Middle East, huge.
We have revolutions as a result of what goes out.
There's some discussion about the role of social media. Certainly helps to organize and promote it. There's still pretty brave people out there who are risking death to stop Morsi. And
didn't this all start because the Egyptian Jon Stewart made fun of his hat?
Yes, the Egyptian Jon Stewart made fun of a hat that Morsi wore during an award ceremony, and because his English was
and his
great.
English was bad.
Yeah.
Bringing this to our side of the pond, there is another story, and this was on AP, and this goes to the state of Washington. A bill amendment proposed Tuesday could allow employers to ask for a worker's Facebook or other social media password during company investigations. The provision was proposed for a bill, and again, this is from the AP, that safeguards social network passwords of workers and job applicants. The measure bars employers from asking for social media credentials during job interviews. But that doesn't mean once you have a job and there is a question of some impropriety, whether they can jump in and access your social media.
And it doesn't mean you can't figure it out on your own. Before somebody gets hired in a place, you can do a little social media search to find out if, you know, they're off the wall. And then the question becomes, should you be allowed to say to somebody who is working for you, no, we don't want you to be wacko which reflects badly on this company?
But I mean, this gets to the central question here. How far is too far?
Yeah, I think that there should there's definitely call for policy. An employer has a right to set a policy. If you're going to use social media, here are the limits, and you have the right to accept them or not going in. But this policy would ask for your passwords. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't give my kids my password. Mm-hmm. And if there's a
I don't know my password.
he has people for that.
If there is a question of impropriety, if the employee, for example, is putting information online that he should not, then you go to the police. And the police have a method that you go through. It's called due process, who gets your private information. But to turn it over to your employer, boy, I don't like the sound of that
at all. I know there was a story that I heard that there was a question of whether Facebook posts, for example, and criticizing your employer were supposed to be acceptable free speech.
And
how does that jive if the employer's got your password?
Well, I do believe that this has to do with criminality.
Yeah.
And
okay,
so that's a different ball of wax. But again,
it's related though. If you on Facebook click like to something that your employer is against,
right,
and they find out about it, it's public. If you click like, it's got the little thumbs up thing.
Yep.
Can you be held accountable for that? That's an expression of your opinion. It's free speech, but you do work for the employer.
It's interesting.
And I think
lines
that policy is set more and more, and more companies saying, here's what you can and cannot do.
Right.
For instance, NPR has clear guidelines where its employees, we have guidelines here, you know, as far as reporters saying political things on their own personal Facebooks. It's a no-no.
Right.
It's you don't do that.
It would be nice if there were one standard clear policy, and that's the problem. It's not. The policies are really different. NPR is very different, for example, than the Washington Post. And when you state your opinion, whether it's political or not, is sometimes a little more blurred than what you made it just sound.
But it's amazing how many people, it seems to me, don't seem to understand that how many people are seeing what they're putting up there and the things they say and the pictures that get posted and all that.
Well, I think this is an interesting angle, too, that Dave Moss of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is based in San Francisco, their private online privacy group. And he's saying, you know, if a company does this in Washington, if this bill goes through in Washington and a company has access to a password and Facebook account, it doesn't just affect the employee. It's everybody else in that circle.
They can totally have access to your whole core of friends.
Yeah. And so where is the line drawn there? So we'll see about that. Let's switch gears to something David has been following all morning long, and really we've all been following for a long time. That is the new laws in Connecticut on guns. David, you've been following this fairly closely. These are the strictest gun control laws in the U.S. President Obama in Colorado yesterday, talking up specifically background checks. He'll be in Connecticut next week, I believe. David, what's the latest?
Well, what I found very interesting is that the debate, and this is being described by NPR this morning, and, you know, we didn't get to hear some of this. I'm sure we will. But how, well, respectful it was. We hear this completely opposite argument going on around the nation that seems to be polarized and lots of shouting. And here, folks in Connecticut, maybe rightly so because of what happened there, but Democrats and Republicans getting together and having an intelligent discussion and coming up with a compromise.
Wow.
And they are hoping that sends the message, that you've heard many of them say that, including Mark Kelly, the husband of Gabrielle Giffords. But it looks like we got restrictions on weapons and large capacity ammunition magazines. Some are set to take effect immediately. Others will be later. But a major agreement in Connecticut.
Alan, did you want to chime in?
Well, you know, there is a political aspect to this. You know, as a political scientist, we like to take a look at the larger thing that's going on here. NPR the other day talked about the political saliency. They didn't use that word. It's a word I use a lot, meaning definition. Is this an issue in which somebody will vote for or against you? Most people don't may have an opinion on gun control. And by the way, the opinions on things like background checks are huge, pro-background check. But those people, the 80% or the 70% who want background checks, they have a lot of other fish to fry. They may vote on abortion. They might vote on something else. But the gun people will vote on this issue. So that if you alienate them, they're going to vote against you. Now, the interesting question then becomes, will those gun people be Obama people in any case? Answer, no. So therefore, Obama goes around the country quite correctly, fights for gun control, says this is the right thing to do, knowing that there's no great loss for him. Those people are not going to vote against him. Now, Cuomo in New York State blinked on the issue. You may remember that he was all for it. He wanted to be the first one. He described the New York SAFE Act as being the biggest gun control measure in the country, which has now been outdone by Connecticut, which was, by the way, criticized for going too slowly, but apparently came up with something good, and Republicans and Democrats were able to agree, agree on it. But I do think, in the end, Obama has turned out to be a very brilliant political strategist. So not only is it a question of what's right, but I think he understands what's going to help those people who are in favor of his kind of administration.
I'm not sure it takes a brilliant political strategist to capitalize on a terrible tragedy to advance something that you've wanted to do all along. I don't think that's political expediency. Getting back to the Connecticut issue, and here's why some of the gun owners are saying, well, now wait a minute. Now, they've added 100 firearms to the state's assault weapons list. The question is this list too excessive? In other words, in New York, there was the issue of they're calling this an assault rifle, but it's not necessarily an assault rifle. In other words, the politicians themselves didn't exactly know what an assault rifle was. Yeah. It was an amorphous definition. So here in Connecticut, they've added 100. They have a state senator who's saying, Tony Guglielmo, says, you know, this wouldn't have saved one life. This is feel-good legislation.
By the way, that is the argument that the NRA and the others are putting out there, that it wouldn't. To me, it's quite clear. If there are fewer guns, if there are fewer people with guns, if there are background checks, it's got to help. I mean,
but the NRA consistently says that won't help, that won't save any lives, we'll reach a compromise. I just don't know what they're saying would help. What's one positive measure?
And they did it the other day. They said we want people carrying.
Teachers.
I also want to see what's in the Connecticut legislation in terms of mental health. They said they've addressed that there, but I haven't heard any details on it yet.
Well,
I'm wondering what that is.
And that's an interesting issue. It's something that I've thought about. A lot of people have had psychotherapy in their lives.
Yes.
So now we get into the question of what is mental illness? Have you ever suffered from mental illness? Well, I don't know. Have you ever seen a therapist? Half the country gets eliminated.
Did you ever say, I want to kill that person?
Right there.
So, David, I don't know the details on this, but do you know any more about what this in Connecticut is being called, the Dangerous Weapon Offender Registry?
I mean,
ordinarily, if you're a dangerous weapon offender, you shouldn't have a gun, right?
Right.
I mean, this is self-evident.
And I apologize. I don't have any more specifics.
But we
on
can
that.
Guess.
But we will.
We can guess that somebody's been picked
somebody's
up
been,
for carrying in some way an illegal weapon, or have used it in a bad way, or the rest of it. I mean, in New York City, in New York State, there's a Sullivan Law for years, in which concealed weapons are forbidden. So it may well be that that's what they're talking about.
Yeah, and I don't
knowing
whether it would go further. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if this list means they can act on it and remove. You know, I don't know.
All right, we'll see how this plays out. David Hopper, our engineer. We're going to take a short break, and then back we'll talk Jimmy Fallon. And The Tonight Show. It's the Roundtable, by golly. It's WAMC. The time is 9:53. The Roundtable on the Roundtable rolls on, and we move to lighter topics now. And, well, the torch is being passed from Jay Leno to Jimmy Fallon. At least that's the you know,
it's on the
front
page of every tabloid this morning.
But that's the plan. We've seen this plan before.
Yes.
And,
didn't
you know,
work out, Mr. Conan.
No, it didn't. And so this is going to happen in the spring of 2014. Leno retiring to do whatever he's going to do. Jimmy Fallon will take over The Tonight Show, and it'll be in New York. Rosemary.
I don't have a dog in this fight. I think it's women who stay up late at night, and they should have a woman comedian.
And who would that be?
Oh, Sarah Silverman comes to mind.
But they'd have to bleep every other word, yes?
Yeah, okay.
Oh, well. All right, fair enough. That's Alan. Remember, we have 5 minutes, 4.5 minutes to fill.
I do not have a dog in this race either. Here's why. Because I go to sleep at 7:30 every night.
See, I told you it's the women who stay
and
up.
And I get up, and I get up at 3:30. Now, I could, of course, TiVo, but then when would I watch
exactly
these things? I've never liked Lenin.
Lenin and Stalin.
What?
Lenin? Clearly not Lenin.
I take great resentment to that. I didn't like either of those guys.
Big fan of Brezhnev as well.
Yes,
So, yes. So, no, I and Fallon, I don't think I've ever laid eyes on him.
Oh, he's a funny man.
He is funny. Yeah.
They're all funny.
St. Rose grad.
No, Leno's not. Leno's not funny.
Leno has some very funny...
and he comes from the area, right? Doesn't Fallon come from Saugerties?
Yeah, he does.
Yeah,
yep. He does.
Yeah. Saugerties High School.
And Leno's from Boston, right?
I don't know.
Massachusetts, I believe.
And I think this is a great move for New York. It's nice to have, you know,
yeah.
It felt
you had
good
to give them a tax break in order to get it done. You know that in the budget.
So did lawmakers
that's
know
good
what
word is not walls have already been knocked down, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, oh, I read it in the paper.
I don't get it. What do you mean?
In other words, they're already renovating for this studio
for
they're
this
gonna build
studio
for
Fallon.
Is it gonna
be Rockefeller Center?
I don't know. Yeah, about that.
Here's a question.
Letterman
for
has
you,
his own
Alan
theater, you know.
The Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's a question for you.
Please.
The sweetheart legislation that went in to bring more shows.
Sure.
It was talked about that maybe this is to bring Jimmy Fallon. Did the lawmakers, did Cuomo, did the leaders know that this was going to happen before we did a week and a half, 2 weeks early?
Well, here, Mr. Bulgannon, I mean Ray, there is what we call a multiplier effect here.
Okay.
So in other words, you know, every time you give some money to a school, they say, well, 25 times that dollar is, I don't know that this is true, but they certainly say that. I know in New York City, you can't walk down the streets anywhere without seeing, in the old days, now it's all over now, that there was no parking on that street because Law and Order.
SVU was being filmed
there, and these orange signs, all yellow signs all over the place. I think it brings life. And life and, you know, and a good sense of self to a city to have that. Why should those people way out there on the left coast have everything, I say? Oh, did I say the left coast? I meant the west coast.
When did Carson move? Was it in the 60s?
That was wrong.
When did Carson move to L.A.?
Oh, boy.
This is why we need Joe.
Was I alive then?
I don't think I was watching the Tonight Show.
I was definitely alive, and I didn't like it one bit. The whole idea there was to get the movie stars.
Yeah.
But here, we'll get, you know, plumbers and...
Oh, that's
and
nice. Plumbers? You know, what about De Niro? What about guys like that?
Well, De Niro, he's good.
He could be on every week.
He was good.
Yeah.
Well, Pacino, De Niro.
De Niro.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Broadway stars.
All right.
That's
well,
good.
I think we run out
Beto,
of steam.
Beto, I knew it was you.
Okay. So let's thank Dave Gustina, our Morning Edition host.
Thank you, David Gustina.
Thank you, David.
Rosemary Mayo comes every week to save us, and she's done it again.
You're the best.
Thank you so much, Rosemary.
We love you, Rosemary.
Alan Shartok was also here. This was great.
Yeah. What do you mean he was also here?
You were here, and that's
the minimus.
That's fantastic.
Lennon.
So that's it. And
I knew it was you, Raymond.
That's all the time we have. Thanks to everybody for listening.
But I'll remember you.
Putting up with us. You can go to online at WAMC.org. You are listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.